This is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Angier. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Now we take a look inside this week's Triangle Business Journal, and as you probably know, if you've listened to the program before, our first page is the biz page. And there are several short articles here. The first one is, Who's the Buyer? And the article is entitled, Group Buys More North Carolina Coast Property. A stealthy LLC with a clever Italian name and ties to San Francisco has paid a big price for even more waterfront property in Beaufort. On May 15, 2018, a North Carolina LLC named Ganze e Libri, which is Italian for hooks and books, paid $2.395 million for a spectacular waterfront home at 2684 Lenoxville Road in Beaufort. But what got people in Carteret County talking was that Ganze e Libri's mailing office and principal office are with the law firm Arnold & Porter in San Francisco. So was a Silicon Valley executive grabbing some beach property before the company moved to North Carolina? On April 6th, Ganze e Libri paid $1.65 million for an adjacent lot, buying it from a Raleigh trust. So that's $4.045 million the LLC has spent in Beaufort, which will buy a bunch of hooks and books. And under the heading of ratings comes the article, Voters Are Fond of North Carolina. A new YouGov poll, that's YOUGOV, asked Americans to pick their preferred state in a head-to-head competition, and North Carolina came out near the top of the list. The state ranked fifth among the 50 states and Washington, D.C. In mid-March, more than 1,200 U.S. adults were asked to choose the better of two states in a series of head-to-head matchups. North Carolina was picked 61.3% of the time, just behind Nevada at 61.4%. At the top of the list is Hawaii, winning 69% of the time, followed by Colorado, Virginia, and Nevada. Washington, D.C. had the worst score at 35%, while Alabama was the lowest-rated state, winning just 38% of the time. South Carolina ranked 29th with a win percentage of 47%. And under the heading of Coming to Life, the article, Kane Realty Joins Chatham Park Project. The developers behind Chatham Park's commercial gateway, called Mosaic, have tapped Kane Realty Corporation to manage the product and lease the Guild apartment homes as work nears completion on the first buildings on the site. Developer Kirk Bradley says, partnering with Kane, a reputable firm with proven expertise and a knowledgeable team, enables us to create the community energy and offer the unique experiences we envisioned from day one. Mosaic makes up the 44-acre commercial portion at the entrance to Chatham Park and includes 2,000 square feet of retail and restaurant space, 88,000 square feet of office space, a Hampton Inn and suites, apartments, and luxury condos. The first of these spaces will open later this year. And under the heading of Big Move, the article, Now You Can Get a Bailey's Box in L.A. Bailey's Fine Jewelry, which started in Rocky Mount and is now based in Raleigh, has made a leap to the West Coast. The firm just opened a showroom at 607 South Hill Street in downtown Los Angeles. The 600 block of Hill Street, which runs through the center of the city, is packed with jewelry firms. We have a lot of connections to them out there, so we thought it would be smart for us to be close to all of them, CEO Trey Bailey says. It's the fifth location for Bailey's, which also plans a store in Cary. And under the heading of banking comes the article, Want Forgiveness? You'll have to wait. A painfully slow trickle is how Triangle bankers describe the forgiveness process when it comes to the largest Paycheck Protection Program loans. Brian Reed, Triangle Market President for Town Bank, says just one $2 million plus loan had been forgiven at his bank, and it was out of his region. It's just a slow, slow process, with the U.S. Small Business Administration, he says, adding, and I'm not sure why. Dogwood State Bank CEO Steve Jones adds, we're having the same experience with loans over $2 million. North Carolina Bankers Association CEO Peter Gwaltney says, bankers and their customers are very frustrated with the length of time involved with larger PPP loan forgiveness applications. And finally, on this week's biz page, under the heading of Chicken Salad Chick, comes the article, Hot Franchise Comes to Cary. A chicken salad franchise that started in the kitchen of an Alabama mom has reached Cary and has plans for more growth. Stacy Brown started making wildly popular varieties of chicken salad in her Auburn home and selling to friends. But after a local health official warned her she couldn't run a business from her kitchen, she opened a small restaurant in 2008, and the concept exploded. The company, Chicken Salad Chick, is now owned by Brentwood Associates of Los Angeles and has 179 restaurants across 17 states. Two retired Coca-Cola executives, John Schuster and Mike Saccone, bought the franchise rights for Wake, Durham, and Orange counties, with plans to open at least six locations over 5 years. Schuster says they visited more than 50 restaurants to consider various franchises before settling on Chicken Salad Chick. The brand especially appeals to affluent women ranging in age from 35 to 55. And so they opened their first store in September at Waverly Place in Cary. According to the company, the franchise fee is $50,000, and the total investment for a store is at least $562,000. Schuster acknowledges that opening a fast casual franchise in a pandemic is tough, but says business is growing, and he's poking around the triangle for more locations. The brand has been extremely resilient, and the consumers have accepted our brand here in Waverly, he says. We're amazed at how the consumers love the product. We've had a lot of people who have come up and said, I'm so glad you came. For others who may want to have a franchise of their own, Schuster says, you have to do your homework. You have to do your due diligence. And we turn the page and reach the tech and transportation page of this week's TBJ. And under the heading of growing comes the article, Why Durham is Big in Fidelity's Hiring Plans. As executives were looking at the Fidelity Investments footprint and plotting the addition of approximately 4,000 new employees over the next several months, the inclusion of the triangle in the plan was a no-brainer. That's because, in addition to being one of the Boston financial giant's largest campuses, the region is also a sweet spot when it comes to technology hires, says Brooke Forbes, Fidelity's CIO and head of technology for personal investing. So the announcement that the firm is planning to hire 225 people in Durham over the next few months made complete sense, she says. We're pretty excited, Forbes says. That area has been high growth for us, candidly, over the last 5 to 7 years. We have locations all over the country, but this particular location is really a central hub for us in hiring for our technology division. TBJ asks how Triangle Hires can stand out amid all the applications Fidelity will be collecting in the coming weeks. Forbes says it's an understanding of the mission, not just cloud credentials. We are a company at heart that is incredibly customer obsessed, and every single associate we talk to, regardless of level of leadership, we all share a real passion for serving our clients in all demographics and backgrounds, she says. Her go-to job interview question? I really like to ask people what gets them out of bed in the morning, what inspires you that you're super passionate about, Forbes says. And a very short article here under the heading of They Said It comes the article, Companies Hit Reset on Corporate Diversity and Inclusion. The renewed movement for racial and social equity that spread across the country last summer brought with it a reckoning in the corporate world on diversity and inclusion, one that is still being dealt with in the C-suites of companies as they examine and improve their own D&I policies. And top diversity and inclusion officers at Cree and Red Hat have advice for other tech firms looking to create and update their own strategies. So here are those two folks. There's Tamara Pierce, who's Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at Durham-based Cree, says, listen to your employees. Take the lead from them to understand what's important and where to start. And from Red Hat, Margaret Dawson, who's Head of Diversity and Inclusion, says, if you start with the diversity, you'll bring in a diverse population. But if you haven't created that inclusive, safe environment, or they don't see anyone who looks like them, they'll just turn around and walk out. And on a larger article here on the tech and transportation page and is entitled Morrisville Firm Expands Its Reach. After months of searching, Morrisville-based InMotion Now has acquired Dutch digital asset management platform developer Lytho, that's Lytho, a move CEO Douglas Thied describes as a growth play. Thied says he's been shopping for a digital asset management firm since he was named CEO in April of 2020. It really matches our customers' needs, he says. We help our customers very well in managing the creative content production process. But what happens after that? Where does the asset go? It's the continuation of a journey our customers are on. Talks between InMotion Now, which offers workflow management solutions, and Lytho began in earnest in June. The pandemic definitely complicated negotiations, Thied says. You typically like to actually meet people before you decide to come together. But times have changed, he says. The use of video calls obviously has been tremendous in order to build a rapport over an ocean. We haven't been able to meet in person. The move is a growth play, Thied says, reiterating his belief that there will be no layoffs related to the transaction. They have a great technology set. We have a great technology set, he says. We have to work to bring them together. We don't want to sacrifice our existing roadmaps on either platform as we bring them together. We need more people to do that. That will likely require more employees, Thied says. And in a continuation of the tech and transportation page, under the heading of By the Numbers comes the article, Triangle Startups Raise More Than $310 Million. 2021 continues to start strong for the Triangle's growth companies, who've collectively raised more than $310 million in outside capital. That's according to a TBJ analysis of data from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission for the first 3 months of the year as the economy rebounds from the pandemic's blow in 2020. Nearly $87 million of that sum was raised by startups in March, including LiveSwitch in Holly Springs, which closed on a $15.9 million raise on March 25th. The sum is directly tied to serial entrepreneur Brian Hamilton's previously disclosed buy of Canadian software firm Frozen Mountain. Another standout funder in the month came from Stride Bio, a $48.9 million raise, according to securities filing from March 26. But the company says it's raised even more, announcing it had raised $81.5 million from the likes of North Pond Ventures, Novo Holdings, and Hatteras Venture Partners. And under the heading of Open Spaces comes the article, Parking Numbers Show COVID Impact at RDU. As airports across the country cautiously eye a comeback, Raleigh-Durham International Airport is monitoring its parking lots. Not yet ready to pull the trigger on fully opening up what has traditionally been its biggest revenue driver, That's despite revenue increases in recent weeks. When COVID-19 tanked demand last year, RDU responded by shuttering multiple parking lots across its campus, operating on what its execs called a survival budget. Today, just the garage between the terminals, the central and premier decks, is in operation. And the reopening of RDU's economy lots isn't imminent, even as traffic has started to tick back up. RDU is monitoring parking availability to determine when additional lots need to reopen and will ensure that all guests have easy access to parking, spokeswoman Stephanie Hawko says. Numbers released by RDU show that millions of dollars likely lost from parking revenue as the pandemic spread. And recovery is happening, but it's slow, the data show. And accompanying this little article is a graph entitled Parking Revenue. And that parking revenue is has three major data points on it. And it starts in January of 2020, at which parking revenue is $5.1 million. And then there's a monthly plot between that and March of this year, 2021. So between January 20th and just a few months later in April, the revenue went from $5.1 million to $149,000. Now, since April of last year, revenue is building back very slowly and has now reached, in March of 2021, a maximum of $1.9 million. Now we'll turn the page in this week's Triangle Business Journal, and we find ourselves on the real estate page. And in the heading of downtown comes the article, Big Project for Rollsville. After years of planning, a New York-based developer with a focus on the Triangle is set to begin work on a massive mixed-use development in the heart of Rollsville as the town works to guide its explosive growth. KDM Development of Pittsford, New York, is about to begin work this year on Cobblestone Crossing, calling for 182 multifamily units and around 50,000 square feet of retail space in Rollsville's growing downtown. The project is situated on 11 acres at the corner of Young and South Main Streets. KDM Vice President Kenyon Burnham says the project is expected to break ground this summer, and the company hopes to complete work by 2023. He says the project is expected to cost between $55 and $60 million. Multifamily units will include 1- and 2-bedroom units. Plans for the project include 8 buildings up to 4 stories high. The project will also include a municipal center, though Burnham says the town has yet to announce exactly what this will entail. KDM will develop the building, though the town is expected to maintain ownership of that part of the property. KDM Development is based just south of Rochester, New York. The company got involved with the site in 2018 after the town released a request for proposals after acquiring much of the land over the years. Ultimately, KDM won out and has spent the last 2+ years working with the town to gain approval for the plans. We're extremely honored to be part of this, Burnham says. He says COVID presented challenges and some delays, but ultimately the company was able to push through and now plans to close on the property later this month. The project joins a number of developments KDM has done and is planning in the Triangle. Despite still being based in New York, the company has almost completely shifted its focus to the Triangle. Nearly all of its development projects are in the region, and the vast majority of its staff has moved to the area as well. We pretty much pivoted the entirety of our focus on the Triangle, Burnham says. It's such a fast-moving market, it doesn't make sense to be anywhere else. And a couple of short articles here, also on the real estate page. Under the heading of Fairview Road comes the article, Five Points Project is Seeking Rezoning. A cluster of properties near Raleigh's Five Points could soon see new life as a boutique mixed-use project. Raleigh's Entitlement Preservation Group has scheduled a neighborhood meeting for the property owners regarding the proposed rezoning of buildings dating to the 1950s. The rezoning would allow up to 48 multifamily units over up to 20,000 square feet of commercial space. The property is on four parcels at 1316 Fairview Road, formerly the site of a Grocery Boy Jr. And under the heading of Big Number, the article is simply entitled $120 million. That's how much a Boston investor paid for a massive apartment complex near Raleigh's North Hills. TA Realty bought the 434-unit Alistair at North Hills apartment complex for $276,497 per unit on April the 9th. The number tops all 2020 sales in the market. And under the heading of vacancies, the article, sluggish office market, ripe for a rebound. As the pandemic stretches on and vaccinations spark hope for a return to a pre-COVID normal, office demand in the Triangle has yet to resurge from its 2020 dips as absorption stays negative and vacancy remains in the double digits. According to JLL, office activity remained low in the first quarter, with a brokerage firm reporting 14.3% vacancy across the Triangle and minus 144,000 square feet of absorption. Still, local brokers see signs of hope and are highlighting the region's growing attraction to businesses nationwide, as well as the rise of life sciences office space as a growing sector in the region. Most of our tenants with plans for expansion in 2019 and 2020 are really dusting off those plans, says Brian Lands, JLL's Director of Research. It feels like there's a tremendous amount of pent-up demand. And also on this week's real estate page, under the heading of Growth Mode, comes the article, Carey Firm Makes Another Acquisition. A real estate brokerage and tech firm in Carey is making its third acquisition of the year, locking down the second half of its plan to build a national portal for buyers around the country. Fathom Holdings recently signed an agreement to acquire LiveBy, a Nebraska-based data aggregation and hyperlocal content firm, and a deal expected to close at $9 billion. The deal is expected to include $3 million in cash and $6 million in Fathom stock, which was trading at $31.90 as of April 13. As part of Fathom, LiveBy will play a pivotal role in the creation of Fathom's planned national real estate portal. This will maybe be made possible in combination with another company recently acquired by Fathom. In February, Fathom announced the acquisition of Neighborly Solutions, an Olympia, Washington-based real estate tech company. Next, we turn the page from the real estate page to the retail and restaurants page of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Fayetteville Street comes the article, Bakery Heading Downtown. The owner of a popular Raleigh bakery is expanding into downtown as part of an effort to bring back economic life to an area hard hit by the pandemic. Andrew Ullum plans to open in the fall a cafe-style version of Union Special Bread that will cater to on-the-go customers who want a taste of his oven-fresh menu. Ullum recently signed a lease for a 1,400-square-foot space at 401 Fayetteville Street that will have variations of his offerings at his location at Gateway Plaza on Crabtree Boulevard. Ullum says the investment was about $600,000 for a complete build-out of his first location, which opened in August 2019, but this time he expects the amount to be a fraction of the cost since he's taking over the former coffee shop, Tama Cafe. The restaurant will feature items with ingredients from local sources. Ullum will partner with third-party services for delivery and offer outdoor seating. Ullum is counting on the once-busy intersection at Fayetteville and East Davis Streets, drawing more traffic as offices reopen and crowds flock to nearby festivals again as the pandemic begins to ebb. I'm optimistic that we'll experience a return of downtown, he says. I don't know that it will be this year. We will open early because we want to make sure that when people return downtown to go to work, we're ready to be busy. More grab-and-go Cole sandwiches, salad, and snaps will be available than at the 2,500-square-foot Gateway location, where customers are most likely to sit down and stay longer. It's also where he runs his wholesale part of the business. In the future, Alum plans to expand his retail business and also partner with local organizations to help those in need in the community. Previously, the Ohio native worked as an executive pastry chef for 7 years for acclaimed Raleigh chef Ashley Christensen's restaurants. And under the heading of This Fall comes the article, Bustling Nightdale to Get First Farm-to-Table Restaurant. A farm-to-table restaurant is set to open in Nightdale and will pay tribute to the town's railroad. The depot on First will transform a house at 608 North First Avenue into a dining establishment with a menu that offers items from North Carolina producers. Nightdale Hospitality Group, including owner Christopher Kritzer and COO Emerald McHale, plans to open the business this fall after renovating the house, which was built in 1935. The name and logo highlight Nightdale's train depot. Nightdale is yearning for locally owned restaurants, McHale says. We want to give the community somewhere that they can go and socialize and eat really good food. That's our biggest priority. They will turn the two-story home into a modern rustic restaurant with elements of the past. Also, they will redo the single-story portion, which was added in the 1960s, to include a dining room with 18-foot ceilings and a patio. McHale estimates the investment to open the restaurant will start at about $2.5 million. The focus will be on seafood, including homemade crab cakes, scallops, and crab legs. Also, steak, chicken, pasta, and vegan, as well as vegetarian and gluten-free options, will be offered. And last article on this retail and restaurants page under the heading of acquisition. The article, Carry Firm Managing $16 Billion Joining European Group. A Carry Financial Services firm has been acquired by a European group seeking to expand its fund services practice. Venture Back Office recently became the first U.S. fund services acquisition for professional services provider TMF Group of the Netherlands, the companies recently announced. Financial details were not disclosed, but the deal now allows TMF Group to administer approximately $178 billion in assets for its clients. VBO will be the fund administrator for the North American market. Founded in 2007, the 70-plus person VBO is a third-party services provider for private equity, real assets, credit, and emerging manager funds. Its assets under management have increased from $1 billion in 2009 to $16 billion in 2021. TMF Group has more than 9,100 employees at 120 offices in over 85 countries. And next we turn to the executive voice page of this week's Triangle Journal. And the executive voice this week belongs to Anthony Scott. For the past 30 years and across four states, Durham Housing Authority CEO Anthony Scott has led community development and affordable housing organizations, developing and bolstering states and cities in their efforts to improve access to affordable housing and economic opportunities in their communities. And for the last 5 years, at the heading of the DHA, Scott continues to pursue initiatives to provide new housing and opportunities to Durham residents, even as explosive growth sends housing costs ever higher. Through it all, Scott continues to make the case that housing affordability is an integral part of economic development. As more and more resources go to attracting new companies to the region, he says housing affordability is an important factor in businesses choosing where to locate. Scott grew up in Delaware, earned a degree in architecture at Howard University. While there, he realized a new passion for designing and developing the communities that contextualize those developments. I wanted to be an architect since the seventh grade. When I got there, I started to look at it differently, he says. It started in my undergrad, pulling the pieces together between a building and a community, and seeing that a building is one thing, but how you look at it in context of the community is something else. At UCLA, Scott enrolled in the urban planning program and was soon connecting with various nonprofits, affordable housing organizations, and local government departments working to guide growth in the city. He got an internship with the mayor's office and connected with the Dunbar Economic Development Corporation, rising to executive director. In 2000, Scott and his wife decided it was time to head back east. Both my wife and I are from the East Coast, and when we had kids, we said we need to decide if we were going to be in L.A. or head back east to family, he says. Scott joined the Virginia Department of Housing and Community Development. After 3 years, he got a job at the Richmond Redevelopment and Housing Authority and eventually became CEO. We had the power of eminent domain, he says. We created redeveloped areas in the city. By 2011, Scott was on to his next role as Deputy Director of Department for the Director of Development for the Baltimore Housing Authority, and he came with big hopes for the job. The BHA, he explains, was a move-to-work agency, one of just 39 in the country, meaning it had a great deal more flexibility in how it allocates funding than other non-MTW authorities. Housing authorities with that designation have done some really innovative things over the years, and some have changed the way housing authorities perform overall, Scott says. But Scott was disappointed we couldn't do more. We had to climb our way out of legacy issues. In 2016, he became DHA's CEO, and he has not been disappointed. The things that I was excited for, the opportunities here, were better than I imagined, Scott says. He says the DHA benefits from a number of complementary advantages, from a city government on board with their efforts to a willing citizenry, excited to vote for new initiatives. Durham really got it as a city with a big C and as a city with a small C, he says. They were able to look forward and say with the growth Durham is having, unless we tackle the affordable housing challenge, we're going to be in a situation where Durham isn't affordable and it won't be able to remain so. For example, residents in Durham overwhelmingly voted in support of a $95 million affordable housing bond in 2019 to go to housing low-income individuals throughout Durham. And over the last 5 years, Scott's put together a number of projects in motion through initiatives such as the DHA Downtown and Neighborhood Plan. The plan leverages authority-owned land throughout the city and finds private development partners to redevelop and repair existing affordable housing to provide hundreds of new housing units across the city. The authority has identified 7 of its properties in and around downtown Durham and has begun working with developers on plans for communities on these parcels. The plan is expected to generate over 2,400 units at varying levels of affordability. And Scott is quick to point out that the authority's work is not just about providing officially designated affordable housing. There are still, of course, challenges. The explosion in growth and developer interest in Durham increasingly pushes market rate home prices and rental rates higher, sometimes beggaring belief by residents who remember a more affordable Durham. Look at all the market rate housing, or what I like to call the above market rate housing, he says. I saw a 3-bedroom apartment listed for $6,000, and I said, are you kidding me? Look what apartments are renting for, and I mean, I'm shocked. This is a problem, Scott says, that can impact more than low-income renters. As more and more resources go into attracting new companies to the region, he says it's important to remember that housing affordability is often a major component in a company's decision to locate in a region. Affordable housing is economic development, Scott says. When you think about companies coming here and growing, if affordability is so high, it's difficult for their employees to find housing. It's difficult for that company to say, yeah, I want to come to the Triangle area. Now we turn to the cover story of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And this cover story features about 24 Healthcare Heroes. In fact, it's entitled Healthcare Heroes, sponsored by First Citizens Bank, Mako Medical, and Crown Trophy in Raleigh. So these were folks who were chosen as outstanding people in the healthcare industry. And there are about 26, as I said, somewhere between 24 and 26, and there's one Lifetime Achievement Award. And so I'm going to read that article, and then I'll try to touch little snippets of the remaining people. After all, this is the Lifetime Achievement Award, and it belongs to Ralph Barrick. It's entitled A Lifetime of Studying Coronaviruses. Remdesivir played a huge part in Operation Warp Speed and the rapid rollout of the Moderna vaccine. These and other aspects of the COVID-19 response have benefited from the research conducted by Dr. Ralph Barrick, professor of epidemiology at the UNC Chapel Hill Giddings School of Global Public Health. Barrick, recipient of Triangle Business Journal's 2021 Healthcare Heroes Lifetime Achievement Award, has dedicated his career to the study of coronaviruses. As early as the 1990s, his research indicated coronaviruses have the ability to mutate, adapt, and traffic between species, including jumping from animals to infect humans. Certainly, the SARS coronavirus in 2003 was a wake-up call that emerging coronaviruses could come out of bat reservoirs, and that was amplified in 2012 with MERS, and then COVID-19 occurred in 2019. And so in the 21st century, we had three emerging coronaviruses all coming out of bats, sort of like we predicted in 1990, Barrick says. Two emerging coronaviruses coming out of animals in less than a decade was an undeniable warning signal to Barrick. He began working on remdesivir in 2014. We didn't know what would cause future outbreaks or pandemics, but if we had antiviral drugs that had broad activity against all the known coronaviruses, then there would be a hope that it would work against a new coronavirus. The initial moment of satisfaction for his lab was when a National Institutes of Health study reported the course of the COVID-19 disease was reduced by several days in patients who received remdesivir, and that there was also a measurable drop in mortality. Remdesivir was the first drug to demonstrate efficacy, and it's the gold standard now. Any new drugs are being layered on top of that drug, Barrick notes. The epiphany moment for the Moderna vaccine came when lab models indicated age didn't matter. Moderna vaccines are really impressive in aged animal models. In fact, there's no difference between young and old, and that was shocking to me because most every other vaccine I had looked at always had an age-related gradient, meaning the vaccine worked really good in young animals, but not so good in old animals. That was a real moment for the Moderna vaccine, and I said, wow, this stuff is going to work. In September, Barrick volunteered to personally be part of the early Moderna vaccine Phase 3 trials. And in addition to his role in the Giddings School, he also serves as scientific director at READDI, which I'll call READDI. It's the Rapidly Emerging Antiviral Drug Discovery Initiative. That's a mouthful. A nonprofit drug research and development organization that was founded in April 2020 as a collaboration between UNC Chapel Hill, the UNC Eshelman Institute of Innovation, and the Structural Genomics Consortium. John Bamforth, who spent the first three decades of his career on the commercial side of pharma at Eli Lilly, before coming to UNC in 2019 as director of the Eshelman Institute for Initiative, is the program director of READDI and works closely with Barrick. The idea is to have a portfolio of antiviral drugs prepared and ready to go when one of these novel viruses emerge, Bamforth says. What the READDI project speaks to is the vision that Ralph has. He can take his science, and he's a world-renowned scientist, particularly in the area of coronaviruses, and he can turn that deep science into a vision of what needs to be done. It's about application. Great scientists are fantastic, but application of that science is where Ralph differentiates himself. One practical example of converting science into application that speaks to Barrick's work, as well as what READDI is trying to achieve, is remdesivir, which Bamforth points out was developed for other diseases, not COVID-19. When COVID-19 emerged, it seemed that remdesivir might work. And sure enough, it did, he says. I love science, but I love science being translated into the real world. And Ralph does a tremendous job of that. The next step to make remdesivir accessible, the next step is to make remdesivir accessible to take in a pill form, which is under development now. A second antiviral drug, molnupiravir, or EIDD-2801, is now in development with Merck. Molnupiravir is an oral tablet sent in phase 2 trials and outpatient settings, Barrick explains. As soon as a patient gets diagnosed as having COVID-19, they can take it in pill form. We're evaluating its effectiveness, and results should be done in a month or so. In November, Barrick's research identified fast-moving new coronavirus variants. What I don't know as these variants emerge is whether it will be like a pendulum with big swings and pathogenesis early on, but eventually it becomes minor, Barrick says, adding there could be another wave of high-path variant that escapes existing immunity. What he thinks is most likely is that the COVID-19 virus will continue infecting people every 3 to 5 years, but it will probably maintain as a common cold virus. The caveats that make such a benign scenario possible are dependent upon 3 things, he says. The first is the percent of the population gets a vaccine. The second will be vaccinating children. And the third is how these variants occur and whether a more genetically different variant emerges over the next 6 to 9 months. While most of the world has been stunned by the pandemic and all it has wrought, Barrick was not. As far as I'm concerned, the world was put on notice in January 2020 when the health minister of China said this community spread was rampant in Wuhan and asymptomatic spread was occurring efficiently. When you have asymptomatic community spread, it's really hard to stop a respiratory virus from circumventing the globe. Pandemics are actually much more common than is commonly understood. The idea that pandemics only occur once every century is total nonsense, Barrick says. It's important to recognize that there have been about 11 outbreaks, epidemics or pandemics, in the 21st century, and we're only 20 years into it. There are 3 coronaviruses, SARS, MERS, and SARS-2. An alpha virus called Zika, 3 or 4 outbreaks of Ebola virus, and 3 pandemic waves of norovirus, which kills about 1,000 people per year in the U.S., but has caused over 200,000 deaths globally each year. And then we have the pandemic flu of 2009. It's important to realize that the data indicates pandemic disease emergence is accelerating, not decelerating, and we need to be prepared. The biggest COVID-19 surprise for him has been the global effort to understand and control the new coronavirus, and that has been inspiring. There has been unprecedented collaboration across the globe, people sharing data and information before they publish to try to make a difference in human health, Barrick says. The development of the vaccine in less than a year is a game changer in terms of pandemic preparedness. It's basically set the standard for how we can get vaccines to human populations quickly in a pandemic setting, and that's a godsend for future generations. With each passing day, it's a true triumph for humanity. Bamforth points to another silver lining that has evolved from the pandemic. The thing that interesting for me to observe as a former pharma guy is that this year has transformed the industry, he says, citing a Harris Poll survey from February that found 62% of Americans gave the pharma industry a thumbs up, versus only a year ago when only 32% rated the pharma industry positively. Now, 2/3 of the general public see pharma as a good thing rather than seeing it negative, Bamforth adds. Understandably so, where would we be without the vaccines? For both scientists who have been a little more than, for both scientists, what has been more than a little frustrating has been the U.S. response. In a pandemic setting, you have to speak with a single voice, and there was no single voice in this pandemic, Barrick laments. noting that the more than 542,000 deaths in the U.S., and it just didn't have to be. Masks and social distancing could have reduced that by half, if not by three quarters. And that would have given us time to roll the vaccine out and make a bigger difference. But it also could have been much worse. If instead of a 1% mortality rate, COVID-19 had the 10% mortality rate of the original SARS-CoV-1 strain of 2003, then the U.S. could have seen more than 5 million deaths in the last year. We as a society need to recognize that COVID-19, as bad as it is, could have been 10 times worse, easily. Look at the 35% mortality rate of MERS. If COVID-19 had that mortality rate, it would be 35 times more death, Barrick says. We need to think about it carefully. A virus with a mortality rate between 10 and 20% is not outside the realm of possibility. We need to think about how we structure our work environment. We need to support public health practices and public health policy across the U.S., and we have to speak with a single voice. Before the pandemic, there were 10 to 20 folks working in Barrick's lab. Now there are 30 to 35. And Barrick says the last year has been completely overwhelming. The collaboration has been so extensive that people are working 16, 18 hours a day. They've been doing it for a year, and they're tired. As I've said, this year was my pinnacle several times. I'm not going to do any better than this, he says. And yet, he isn't slowing down or resting on the laurels of this Lifetime Achievement Award. It's important to note, any time somebody receives an award like this, the recognition has to go beyond the individual. It has to go to the lab, at the people that I've had the honor to work with over the years at UNC and across the U.S. and the globe, Barrick says. Now, there's simply no way for me to read all of the information about all these healthcare heroes. There are 24 of them. So I'm simply going to read all their names. I feel like their names are important, as well as their organization. So we begin with veterinarian Stephen Marks from the NC State of College Vet Medicine. Under COVID-19 frontline support personnel, Jody Fleming with NCHA Strategic Partners. Under nurse, Christian Turner, UNC Health. For dentist, Zachary Bryan, the North Carolina Oral Health Collaborative Foundation for Health Leadership and Innovation. Another COVID-19 frontline healthcare worker is Majimbaya Namdi. He's with Wake Emergency Physicians, PA. Under the volunteer department is Kathy Burns, who volunteers at UNC Health. Under medical professionals is Julia O'Coyne, UNC Rex Healthcare. Under the physician and physician practice groups is Christopher McGowan, True You Weight Loss. Under the heading of community outreach, the UNC Health Mobile COVID-19 Testing Unit team. Under rising star, Mustafa Khan with Raleigh Radiology. Also under rising star, Carolyn Quincy with UNC Chapel Hill. For healthcare manager, Orlando Reyes with UNC Rex Healthcare. Another person under the heading of community outreach is Andrew Herrera with Cure Americas Global. The physician practice group, Michelle Benoit Wilson with Wake Med Health and Hospitals. For support services, Eric Harvey with MMS Holdings. Under the heading of innovator/researcher, Kenneth Murray with Wake Med Health and Hospitals. Now singled out a subdivision of this group for the Adolescent and Young Adult Cancer Champion Awards. First, Andrew Smitherman, UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. Also under this category, Lauren Lux, who is also with the UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. Under the heading of Allied Health Professional, Michelle Crook with the Urban Ministries of Wake County. Also under the heading of Physician and Physician Practice Group is Luke Smith, who is with El Futuro. Under the heading of nurse, we have a couple of folks here. First, Candace Gentry with Duke Regional Hospital. And next, Kirsten Butler, also with Duke University Hospital. And finally, under the heading of Support Services Executive Organization is Jane Pleasance, who's with Duke University and the Duke University Health System. And last but not least, another COVID-19 frontline healthcare worker is Javon Peterson with Duke Raleigh Hospital. These folks are all to be congratulated, highly distinguished careers, and the tragedy is that I don't have time to read all of the data on each individual. So congratulations, folks. Good job. Now, as we near the end of this week's broadcast, we turn to the Viewpoint page, and under the heading of the editor's notebook, why people are moving to Wake County in droves. What you're about to read is not complicated, and it did not require months of extensive research. Online research firm Smart Asset did it for us. Based on recent numbers from the U.S. Census Bureau and the American Community Survey, the latest Purchasing Power Index was shipped to us, and the results for some Triangle counties are very encouraging. Why? Because of two primary reasons. Wake County, by all accounts, still a place to buy a house, especially when compared to the potential income levels in other areas in the state. The second reason is the cost of living gap between some of the nation's largest areas, such as New York City, San Francisco, and Chicago, is growing when compared to the Triangle region. The current number of 67 people moving into our neighborhoods every day is expected to go up in the coming months. Here's the theory. Based on Smart Assets calculation, if you live in New York right now and are making about $75,000 to $80,000 a year, you would only need to make about $60,000 in Raleigh to have the same standard of living. Obviously, you need to make a little more if you want to buy a house and have some saved money to put a down payment on a house, but you get the point. That gap has widened. Not only that, but Wake's median income has risen to $80,000, buoyed by companies such as Fidelity, Credit Suisse, IHS Market, Red Hat IBM, and others. Population density is playing a bigger role in people's choices. We're hearing that executives of some large companies are beginning to move to the area well ahead of companies that are still headquartered elsewhere. That's because of the accepted work-from-home policy by most large companies. This trend was not prevalent before, so what we are beginning to notice is more and more mid-size and larger companies are moving headquarter operations to places that offer workers and executives more flexibility. Anecdotally, we knew that was the case, but now we're seeing it in the numbers. For private equity principals, real estate developers, and venture capitalists, this is an opportunity. The potential of attracting new skills and talent and not having to break the bank in the process. That median income curve for Wake, Orange, Johnston, and other Triangle counties will flatten eventually if the economy starts shedding jobs, or if we're not able to keep up the pace of adding jobs and inching toward full employment. Right now, that scenario is far away. Currently, these cost of living numbers show us that our population growth and the strain on our infrastructure is not ending anytime soon. And the last article this week is the guest column for the Viewpoint page, and it's written by John Hood, entitled "Nationalizing Politics Was a Mistake." If Californians want to make their government the monopoly payer of all medical bills, why should North Carolinians be able to tell them they can't? If a federal republic populated by 330 million people, spread across some 3.5 million square miles of sprawling territory, we should be asking precisely this kind of fundamental question, rather than the screaming at each other across partisan and geographical divides about such issues as education, health care, public assistance, and pandemic response. I know that's not the way most of us are primed to think about politics anymore. We see restaurants in our communities decimated by the COVID-19 crisis and ask what Congress should do about it. We run over potholes or experience spotty internet coverage and wonder if the Biden administration's new infrastructure bill will fix the problem. We worry about chronic poverty and debate various federal tax and spending policies to combat it. This impulse to nationalize politics is inconsistent with America's traditions. It's unwieldy and fosters social division. I also think it's just plain weird. I'm not arguing for states' rights or some such rot. Only individuals have rights. Governments have powers. In our federal system, the national government had certain powers listed and authorized by the Constitution, powers that only a national government can effectively perform. National defense is a familiar example. Another is, in fact, protecting us against state and local infringements of our individual rights to life, liberty, and property. But the United States Constitution was never meant to guarantee all Americans the right to drive smooth roads or to access the Internet at high speeds or even to have someone's medical bills paid for by someone else. Perhaps those services ought to be provided by government. Perhaps not. But that's the kind of call that should be made closer to home. After all people who reside in the United States also reside in states and localities. The federal government is not, in reality, some separate entity that can pay for things we'd otherwise have to finance ourselves. All federal dollars are either taxed away from us in real time or borrowed from bondholders who will have to be paid by taxing away our money sometime in the future. Yes, I know nationalizing public policy can make money flows more complicated. The residents of some states end up subsidizing the residents of others. I see this as a bug, not a feature. If Floridians want to build expensive homes, condos, or tourist attractions in the path of hurricanes, it should be up to them to cover the cost if they bet wrong by collecting revenues from their residents and visitors. By nationalizing policy issues to such an extreme degree, we've ruined our political discourse. We've turned every federal election into a potential catastrophe in someone's mind. We've made the stakes too high. Let's devolve, decentralize, and de-escalate before it's too late. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. So long. Till next time.